This book contains up to four sides per cassette. Side 1, RC49424. Dolphin Island by Arthur C. Clarke. Copyright 1963 by Arthur C. Clarke. Read by Randy Davidson. This book contains 188 pages on four sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to locate the beginning of the book. Library of Congress Annotation. In this suspenseful science fiction tale, 16-year-old Johnny Clinton is rescued by dolphins after the hovership he had stowed away on crashed in the Pacific. For grades 6 to 9, 1963. From the book jacket. Late one night in the future, far, far out at sea, a young man adrift on a packing crate is about to encounter an intelligence that will change the course of history. Dolphin Island is science fiction master Arthur C. Clarke's beloved classic of the young stowaway who is rescued by the people of the sea, and who in turn helps them defeat an enemy even more ancient and more ruthless than man. Chapter 1. Johnny Clinton was sleeping when the hover ship raced down the valley, floating along the old turnpike on its cushion of air. The whistling roar in the night did not disturb him, for he had heard it almost all his life. To any boy of the 21st century, it was a sound of magic, telling of far-off countries and strange cargoes carried in the first ships that could travel with equal ease across land and sea. No, the familiar roar of the air jets could not awaken him, though it might haunt his dreams. But now it had suddenly stopped, here in the middle of Transcontinental Thruway 21. That was enough to make Johnny sit up in bed, rubbing his eyes and straining his ears into the night. What could have happened? Had one of the great landliners really halted here, 400 miles from the nearest terminus? Well, there was one way to find out. For a moment he hesitated, not wishing to face the winter cold. Then he plucked up his courage, wrapped a blanket around his shoulders, quietly eased up the window and stepped out onto the balcony. It was a beautiful, crisp night, with an almost full moon lighting up every detail of the sleeping landscape. Johnny could not see the turnpike from the southern side of the house, but the balcony ran completely around the old-fashioned building, and it took him only seconds to tiptoe around to the northern face. He was especially careful to be quiet when passing the bedrooms of his aunt and cousins. He knew what would happen if he woke them. But the house slept soundly beneath the winter moon, and none of his unsympathetic relatives stirred as Johnny tiptoed past their windows. Then he forgot all about them, for he saw that he had not been dreaming. The hover ship had left the wide lane of the turnpike and, with lights blazing, lay on flat ground a few hundred yards to the side of the thruway. Johnny guessed that it was a freighter, not a passenger liner, for there was only one observation deck, and that ran for only part of the vessel's 500 feet of length. The ship looked, Johnny could not help thinking, exactly like a giant flat iron, except that instead of a handle running lengthwise, there was a streamlined bridge crosswise, a third of the distance back from the bows. Above the bridge a red beacon was flashing on and off, warning any other craft that might come this way. She must be in some kind of trouble, thought Johnny. I wonder how long she'll be here. Time for me to run down and have a good look at her? He had never seen a hover ship at close quarters, at least not one at rest. He didn't see much when they roared past at 300 miles an hour. It did not take him long to make up his mind. 10 minutes later, hurriedly dressed in his warmest clothes, he was quietly unbolting the back door. As he stepped out into the freezing night, he never dreamed that he was leaving the house for the last time. And even if he had known, he would not have been sorry. Chapter 2. The closer Johnny approached it, the more enormous the hover ship appeared. Yet it was not one of the giants like the 100,000-ton oil or grain carriers that sometimes went whistling through the valley. It probably grossed only 15 or 20,000 tons. Across its bows it bore the words, Santa Ana, Brasilia, in somewhat faded lettering. Even in the moonlight, Johnny had the distinct impression that the whole ship could do with a new coat of paint and a general cleanup. If the engines were in the same state as the patched and shabby hull, that would explain this unscheduled halt. There was not the slightest sign of life as Johnny circumnavigated the stranded monster. But this did not surprise him. Freighters were largely automatic, and one this size was probably run by less than a dozen men. If his theory was correct, they would all be gathered in the engine room, trying to find what was wrong. Now that she was no longer supported by her jets, the Santa Ana rested on the huge, flat-bottomed buoyancy chambers that served to keep her afloat if she came down on the sea. They ran the full length of the hull, and as Johnny walked along them, they loomed above him like overhanging walls. In several places it was possible to scale those walls, for there were steps and handholds recessed into the hull, leading to entrance hatches about 20 feet from the ground. Johnny looked thoughtfully at these openings. Of course they were probably locked, but what would happen if he did go aboard? With any luck, he might have a good look around before the crew caught him and threw him out. It was the chance of a lifetime, and he'd never forgive himself if he missed it. He did not hesitate any longer, but started to climb the nearest ladder. About 15 feet from the ground, he had second thoughts, and paused for a moment. It was too late. The decision was made for him. Without any warning, the great curving wall to which he was clinging like a fly began to vibrate. A roaring howl, as of 1,000 tornadoes, shattered the peaceful night. Looking downward, Johnny could see dirt, stones, tufts of grass being blasted outward from beneath the ship as the Santa Ana hoisted herself laboriously into the air. He could not go back. The jets would blow him away like a feather in a gale. The only escape was upward, and he had better get aboard before the ship started to move. What would happen if the hatch was locked? He dared not imagine. He was in luck. There was a handle, folded flush with the surface of the metal door, which opened inward to reveal a dimly lit corridor. A moment later, heaving a great sigh of relief, Johnny was safely inside the Santa Ana. As he closed the door, the scream of the jets died to a muffled thunder, and at the same moment, he felt the ship beginning to move. He was on his way to an unknown destination. For the first few minutes, he was scared. Then he realized that there was nothing to worry about. He had only to find his way to the bridge, explain what had happened, and he'd be dropped off at the next stop. The police would get him home in a few hours. Home. But he had no home. There was no place where he really belonged. 12 years ago, when he was only 4, both his parents had been killed in an air crash. Ever since then, he had lived with his mother's sister. Aunt Martha had a family of her own, and she had not been very pleased at the addition. It had not been so bad while plump, cheerful Uncle James was alive, but now that he was gone, it had become more and more obvious to Johnny that he was a stranger in the house. So why should he go back, at least before he had to do so? This was a chance that would never come again. And the more he thought about it, the more it seemed to Johnny that fate had taken charge of his affairs. Opportunity beckoned, and he would follow where it led. His first problem would be to find somewhere to hide. That should not be difficult, in a vessel as large as this, but unfortunately he had no idea of the Santa Ana's layout, and unless he was careful, he might blunder into one of the crew. Perhaps the best policy would be to look for the cargo section, for no one would be likely to go there while the ship was on the move. Feeling very much like a burglar, Johnny began to explore and was soon completely lost. He seemed to wander for miles along dimly lit corridors and passageways, up spiral stairs and down vertical ladders, past hatches and doors bearing mysterious names. Once he ventured to open one of these when he found the sign, "Main Engines, Too Much to Resist." Very slowly he pushed the metal door ajar and found himself looking down into a huge chamber almost filled with turbines and compressors. Great air ducts, thicker than a man, led from the ceiling and out through the floor, and the sound of 100 hurricanes shrieked in his ears. The wall on the far side of the engine room was covered with instruments and controls, and three men were examining these with such attention that Johnny felt quite safe in spying on them. In any case, they were more than 50 feet away from him, and would hardly notice a door that had been opened a couple of inches. They were obviously holding a conference, mostly by signs, since it was impossible to talk in this uproar. Johnny soon realized that it was more of an argument than a conference, for there was much violent gesticulation, pointing to meters and shrugging of shoulders. Finally, one of the men threw up his arms as if to say, "I wash my hands of the whole business," and stalked out of the engine room. The Santa Ana, Johnny decided, was not a happy ship. He found his hiding place a few minutes later. It was a small storage room about 20 feet square, crammed with freight and baggage. When Johnny saw that every item was addressed to places in Australia, he knew that he would be safe until he was a long, long way from home. There would be no reason for anyone to come here until the ship had crossed the Pacific and was on the other side of the world. Johnny clawed a small space among the crates and parcels and sat down with a sigh of relief, resting his back against a large packing case labeled Bundaberg Chemical Pty. He wondered what Pty stood for, and still hadn't hit upon proprietary, when excitement and exhaustion caught up with him, and he fell asleep on the hard metal floor. When he awoke, the ship was at rest. He could tell this immediately because of the silence and the absence of all vibration. Johnny looked at his watch and saw that he had been aboard for 5 hours. In that time, assuming that she had made no other unscheduled stops, the Santa Ana could easily have traveled 1,000 miles. Probably she had reached one of the great inland ports along the Pacific coast, and would be heading out to sea as soon as she had finished loading cargo. If he was caught now, Johnny realized, his adventure would soon be ended. He had better stay where he was until the ship was on the move again, far out over the ocean. She would certainly not turn back to discharge, a 16-year-old stowaway. But he was hungry and thirsty. Sooner or later he would have to get some food and water. The Santa Ana might be waiting here for days, and in that case he'd be starved out of his hiding place. He decided not to think about eating, though that was difficult because it was now his breakfast time. Great adventurers and explorers, Johnny told himself firmly, had suffered far worse hardships than this. Luckily, the Santa Ana remained only an hour at this unknown port of call. Then, to his great relief, Johnny felt the floor start to vibrate and heard the distant shrilling of the jets. There was an unmistakable lifting sensation as the ship heaved herself off the ground, then a surge as she moved forward. In 2 hours, thought Johnny, he should be well out at sea, if his calculations had been correct, and this was indeed the last stop on land. He waited out the 2 hours as patiently as he could, then decided it was safe to give himself up. Feeling just a little nervous, he set off in search of the crew and, he hoped, of something to eat. But it was not as easy to surrender as he had expected. If the Santa Ana had appeared large from the outside, from the inside she seemed absolutely enormous. He was getting hungrier and hungrier, and had still seen no signs of life. He did, however, find something that cheered him considerably. This was a small porthole, which gave him his first view of the outside world. It was not a very good view, but it was quite enough. As far as he could see, there was a gray, choppy expanse of waves. There was no sign of land, nothing but empty water, racing by beneath him at a tremendous speed. It was the first time that Johnny had ever seen the ocean. All his life he had lived far inland among the hydroponic farms of the Arizona desert or the new forests of Oklahoma. To see so much wild and unconfined water was wonderful and a little terrifying. He stood for a long time staring through the porthole, trying to grasp the fact that he was indeed racing away from the land of his birth, toward a country of which he knew nothing. It was certainly too late now to change his mind. He found the answer to the food problem quite unexpectedly when he stumbled upon the ship's lifeboat. It was a 25-foot, completely enclosed motor launch, tucked under a section of the hull that could be opened like a huge window. The boat was slung between two small cranes that could swing outward to drop it in the sea. Johnny could not resist climbing into the little boat, and the first thing he noticed was a locker marked Emergency Rations. The struggle with his conscience was a brief one. 30 seconds later, he was nibbling biscuits and some kind of compressed meat. A tank of rather rusty water soon satisfied his thirst, and presently he felt much better. This was not going to be a luxury cruise, but its hardships would now be endurable. This discovery made Johnny change his plans. There was no need to give himself up. He could hide for the whole duration of the trip, and with any luck, he could walk off at the end without being spotted. What he would do afterward, he had no idea, but Australia was a big place, and he was sure that something would turn up, back in his hideout, with enough food for the 20 hours that was the longest that the voyage could possibly last. Johnny tried to relax. Sometimes he dozed, sometimes he looked at his watch and tried to calculate where the Santa Ana must be. He wondered if she should stop at Hawaii or one of the other Pacific islands, and hoped that she would not. He was anxious to start his new life as quickly as possible. Once or twice he thought of Aunt Martha. Would she be sorry that he had run away? He did not believe so, and he was sure that his cousins would be very happy to have got rid of him. One day, when he was rich and successful, he would contact them again, just for the satisfaction of seeing their faces. And that went for most of his classmates, too, especially those who made fun of his small size and called him tiny. He'd show them that brains and determination were more important than brawn. It was pleasant to lose himself in such fantasies, and from them he drifted slowly into sleep. He was still asleep when the voyage ended. The explosion shook him awake instantly, and a few seconds later he felt the impact as the Santa Ana crashed into the sea. Then the lights went out, and he was left in total darkness. Chapter 3. It was the first time in his life that Johnny had ever felt utter, unreasoning panic. His limbs had turned to jelly. He could hardly breathe for the weight that was pressing on his chest. It seemed that he was already drowning, as indeed he might soon be unless he could escape from this trap. He had to find the way out. But he was surrounded by crates and packing cases and soon lost all sense of direction as he blundered among them. It was like one of those nightmares when you tried to run and couldn't, but this was no dream. It was all too real. The pain and shock of crashing against some unseen obstacle jarred him out of his panic. It was no good losing his head and stumbling around in the dark. The thing to do was to keep moving in the same direction until he found the wall. Then he could work along it until he came to the door. The plan was excellent. But there were so many obstructions that it seemed an age before he felt smooth metal in front of him and knew that he had reached the wall of the compartment. After that, the rest was easy, and he almost cried with relief when he found the door and jerked it open. For the corridor outside was not, as he had feared, also in darkness. The main lights had failed, but a dim blue emergency system was operating, and he could see without difficulty. It was then that he noticed the smell of smoke and realized that the Santa Ana was on fire. He also noticed that the corridor was no longer level. The ship was badly down at the stern, where the engines were. Johnny guessed that the explosion had breached the hull, and that the sea was coming in. Perhaps the ship was in no danger, but he could not be sure. He did not like the way she was listing, still less the ominous creaking of the hull. The helpless ship was rolling and pitching in a most unpleasant manner, and Johnny felt a sensation in the pit of his stomach that he guessed must be the first sign of seasickness. He tried to ignore it and to concentrate on the more important matter of staying alive. If the ship was sinking, he had better find his way to the lifeboat as quickly as possible. That would be where everyone else would be heading. The crew would be surprised to find another passenger, and he hoped there would be enough room for him. But where was the lifeboat section? He had been there only once, and though he was sure he could find his way if he had plenty of time, this was just what he lacked. Because he was in such a hurry, he took several wrong turnings and had to retrace his footsteps. Once he found his way blocked by a massive steel bulkhead, which he was certain had not been there before. Smoke curled around its edges, and Johnny could hear, quite distinctly, a steady crackling sound from the far side. He turned and ran as fast as he could back along the dimly lit passageway. He was exhausted and desperately frightened when he finally got back on the correct track. Yes, this was the right corridor. There would be a short flight of stairs at the end, and that would lead to the lifeboat section. He started to run now that he was near his goal and had no need to conserve his strength. His memory had not played him false. The stairs were there, just as he had expected, but the boat was gone. The hole was wide open, and the davits were slung outward with their empty pulley blocks waving as if to tantalize him. Through the huge gap that had been opened to pass the lifeboat, fierce gusts of wind were blowing, bringing flurries of spray. The taste of salt was already bitter in Johnny's mouth. Soon he would know it only too well. Sick at heart, he walked to the opening and looked out over the sea. It was night, but the moon that had seen the beginning of his adventure still shone upon its ending. Only yards below, an angry sea was smashing against the side of the ship, and ever and again a wave came climbing up the hull and went swirling around his feet. Even if the Santa Ana was not shipping water elsewhere, she would soon be doing so here. Somewhere not far away, there was a muffled explosion, and the emergency lights flickered and died. They had served him just long enough, or he could never have found his way here in the darkness. But did it matter anyway? He was alone in a sinking ship hundreds of miles from land. He peered out into the night, searching for some sign of the lifeboat, but the sea was empty. The launch could, of course, be standing by on the other side of the Santa Ana, and he would be unable to see it. This seemed the most likely explanation, for the crew would hardly have left the area while the ship was still afloat. Yet they had certainly wasted no time, so they must have known that the situation was serious. Johnny wondered if the Santa Ana was carrying a cargo of explosives or inflammables, and if so, just when it would go up. A wave slapped against his face, blinding him with spray. Even during these few minutes the sea had crept appreciably higher. Johnny would not have believed that so large a ship could go down so quickly. But hover ships, of course, were very lightly built, and were not designed for this sort of treatment. He guessed that the water would be level with his feet in about 10 minutes. He was wrong. Suddenly, without any warning, the Santa Ana checked her slow, regular wallow, and gave a great lurch, like a dying animal trying to get to its feet for the last time. Johnny did not hesitate. Some instinct told him that she was going down, and that he had better get as far away as he could. Bracing himself for the chill, he hit the water in a smooth, clean dive. Even as he went under, he was surprised to experience not cold, but warmth. He had forgotten that during these last few hours he had passed from winter into summer. When he came to the surface, he started swimming with all his might in his clumsy but effective overarm stroke. Behind him he heard monstrous gurglings and crashings, and a roaring sound as of steam escaping from a geyser. Abruptly, all these noises ceased. There was only the moaning of the wind and the hissing of the waves as they swept past him into the night. The tired old Santa Ana went down smoothly without any fuss, and the backward suction that Johnny had feared never arrived. When he was sure that it was all over, he started to tread water while he surveyed the situation, and the first thing that he saw was the lifeboat, less than half a mile away. He waved his arms and shouted at the top of his voice, but it was quite useless. The boat was already leaving. Even had anyone been looking back, it was unlikely that he would have been spotted. And of course no one would have dreamed that there was another survivor to be picked up. Now he was alone, beneath a yellow, westering moon, and the strange stars of the southern skies. He could float here for hours. The sea, he had already noticed, was much more buoyant than the freshwater creeks in which he had learned to swim. But however long he stayed afloat, it would make no difference in the end. There was not one chance in a million that anybody would find him. His last hope had vanished with the departing lifeboat. Something bumped into him, making him yelp with surprise and alarm. But it was only a piece of debris from the ship. The water around him, Johnny noticed, was full of floating objects. The discovery raised his spirits a little, for if he could make a raft, that would improve his chances considerably. Perhaps he might even drift to land like those men who had ridden the Pacific currents on the famous Contiki almost a century ago. He began swimming toward the slowly swirling debris, and found that the sea had suddenly become much smoother. Oil, oozing from the wreck, had calmed the waves, which no longer hissed angrily, but rose and fell in sluggish undulations. At first their height had scared him, but now as he bobbed up and down with their passage, he found that they could do him no harm. Even in his present predicament, it was exciting to know that one could rise safely and effortlessly over the biggest wave. Presently he was pushing his way among floating boxes, pieces of wood, empty bottles, and all sorts of small flotsam. None of this was any use to him. He wanted something big enough to ride on. He had almost given up all hope of finding it, when he noticed a dark rectangle rising and falling in the swell about 50 feet away. When he reached it, he was delighted to find that it was a large packing case. With some difficulty, he scrambled aboard and found that it could carry his weight. The raft was not very stable, and had a tendency to capsize until Johnny spread himself flat across it. Then it rode the waves with about 3 inches to spare. In the brilliant moonlight, Johnny could read the stenciled letters across which he was lying. They said, "Please store in a cold, dry place." Well, he was hardly dry, but he was certainly getting cold. The wind blowing across his wet clothes was making him feel uncomfortably chilly. But he would have to put up with this until the sun rose. He looked at his watch and was not surprised to see that it had stopped. Even so, the time it showed made no sense. Then he remembered that he must have crossed many time zones since he stole aboard the ill-fated Santa Ana. By now his watch would be at least 6 hours fast. He waited, shivering on his little raft, watching the moon go down and listening to the noises of the sea. Though he was worried, he was no longer badly frightened. He had had so many narrow escapes that he had begun to feel that nothing could harm him. Even though he had no food or water, he was safe for several days. He refused to think further ahead than that. The moon slid down the sky, and the night grew darker around him. As it did so, he saw to his astonishment that the sea was ablaze with floating particles of light. They flashed on and off, like electric signs, and formed a luminous lane behind his drifting raft. When he dipped his hand in the water, fire seemed to flow from his fingers. The sight was so wonderful that for a moment he forgot his danger. He had heard that there were luminous creatures in the sea, but he had never dreamed that they existed in such countless myriads. For the first time he began to glimpse something of the wonder and mystery of the great element that covered 3/4 of the globe, and which now controlled his destiny. The moon touched the horizon, seemed to hover there for a moment, and then was gone. Above him the sky was ablaze with stars, the ancient ones of the old constellations, the brighter ones that had been put there by man in the 50 years since he had ventured into space. But none of these were as brilliant as the stars that flashed beneath the sea in such billions that the raft appeared to float upon a lake of fire. Even when the moon had set, it seemed ages before the first sign of dawn. Then Johnny saw a faint hint of light in the eastern sky, watched eagerly as it spread along the horizon, and felt his heart leap as the golden rim of the sun pushed up over the edge of the world. Within seconds, the stars of sky and sea had vanished, as if they had never existed, and day had come. He had barely time to savor the beauty of the dawn when he saw something that robbed the morning of all its hope. Heading straight toward him out of the west, with a speed and purpose that chilled his blood, were dozens of gray triangular fins. Chapter 4. As those fins sliced toward the raft, cutting through the water with incredible speed, Johnny thought of all the gruesome tales he had read about sharks and shipwrecked sailors. He drew himself up into as little space as possible at the center of the packing case. It wobbled alarmingly, and he realized how small a push would be needed to turn it over. To his surprise, he felt little fear, only a kind of numbed regret and a hope that, if the worst came to the worst, it would all be over quickly. And it seemed a pity, too, that no one would ever know what had happened to him. Then the water around the raft was full of sleek gray bodies, switchbacking along the surface in a graceful roller coaster motion. Johnny knew almost nothing about the creatures of the sea, but surely sharks did not swim in this fashion. And these animals were breathing air just as he was. He could hear them wheezing as they went by, and he caught glimpses of blowholes opening and closing. Why, of course, they were dolphins! Johnny relaxed and no longer tried to hide himself in the middle of his raft. He had often seen dolphins in movies or on television, and he knew that they were friendly, intelligent creatures. They were playing like children among the wreckage of the Santa Ana, butting at the floating debris with their streamlined snouts, making the strangest whistling and creaking noises as they did so. A few yards away, one had reared its head completely out of the water and was balancing a plank on its nose, like a trained animal in a circus act. It seemed to be saying to its companions, "Look at me! See how clever I am?" The strange, unhuman but intelligent head turned toward Johnny, and the dolphin dropped its plaything with an unmistakable gesture of surprise. It sank back into the water, squeaking with excitement, and a few seconds later, Johnny was surrounded by glistening, inquisitive faces. They were smiling faces, too, for the mouths of the dolphins seemed to be frozen in a kind of fixed grin, one so infectious that Johnny found himself smiling back at them. He no longer felt alone. Now he had companionship, even though it was not human, and could do nothing to help him. It was fascinating to watch the leathery, dove-gray bodies moving around him with such effortless ease as they hunted among the debris of the Santa Ana. They were doing this, Johnny soon realized, purely out of playfulness and fun. They were more like lambs gamboling in a spring meadow than anything he had ever expected to find in the sea. The dolphins continued to bob up and to look at him from time to time, as if making sure that he had not run away. They watched with great curiosity as he pulled off his sodden clothing and spread it to dry in the sun. And they seemed to be giving the matter careful thought when Johnny asked them solemnly, "Well, what shall I do now?" One answer to that question was obvious. He had to arrange some shelter from the tropical sun before it roasted him alive. Luckily, this problem was quickly solved. He was able to build a little wigwam from some pieces of driftwood which he lashed together with his handkerchief and then covered with his shirt. When he had finished, he felt quite proud of himself and hoped that his audience appreciated his cleverness. Now he could do nothing but lie down in the shade and conserve his strength while the wind and the currents carried him to an unknown fate. He did not feel hungry, and though his lips were already dry, it would be several hours before thirst became a serious problem. The sea was much calmer now, and low, oily waves were rolling past with a gentle, undulating motion. Somewhere Johnny had come across the phrase, "rocked in the cradle of the deep." Now he knew exactly what it meant. It was so soothing, so peaceful here, that he could almost forget his desperate position. He was content to stare at the blue sea and the blue sky, and to watch the strange yet beautiful animals that glided and swooped around him, sometimes hurling their bodies clear out of the water in the sheer joy of life. Something jolted the raft, and he awoke with a start. For a moment he could hardly believe that he had been sleeping and that the sun was now almost overhead. Then the raft jerked again, and he saw why. Four dolphins, swimming side by side, were pushing the raft through the water. Already it was moving faster than a man could swim, and it was still gaining speed. Johnny stared in amazement at the animals, splashing and snorting only inches away from him. Was this another of their games? Even as he asked himself that question, He knew that the answer was no. The whole pattern of their behavior had changed completely. This was deliberate and purposeful. Playtime was over. He was in the center of a great pack of the animals, all now moving steadily in the same direction. There were scores, if not hundreds, ahead and behind, to right and left, as far as he could see. He felt that he was moving across the ocean in the midst of a military formation, a brigade of cavalry. He wondered how long they would keep it up, but they showed no signs of slackening. From time to time, one of the dolphins would drop away from the raft, and another would immediately take its place, so that there was no loss of speed. Though it was very hard to judge how fast he was moving, Johnny guessed that the raft was being pushed along at over 5 miles an hour. There was no way of telling, however, whether he was moving north, south, east, or west. He could get no compass bearings from the almost vertical sun. Not until much later in the day did he discover that he was heading toward the west, for the sun was going down in front of him. He was glad to see the approach of night, and looked forward to its coolness after the scorching day. By this time he was extremely thirsty. His lips were parched and cracked, and though he was tantalized by the water all around him, he knew that it would be dangerous to drink it. His thirst was so overpowering that he did not feel any hunger. Even if he had some food, he would be unable to swallow it. It was a wonderful relief when the sun went down, sinking in a blaze of gold and red. Still, the dolphins drove on into the west beneath the stars and the rising moon. If they kept this up all through the night, Johnny calculated, they would have carried him the best part of 100 miles. They must have a definite goal, but what could it be? He began to hope that there was land not far away, and that for some unknown reason these friendly and intelligent creatures were taking him to it. But why they were going to all this trouble he could not imagine. The night was the longest that Johnny had ever known, for his growing thirst would not allow him to sleep. To add to his distress, he had been badly sunburned during the day, and he kept twisting and turning on the raft in a vain attempt to find a comfortable position. Most of the time he lay flat on his back, using his clothes to protect the sore spots, while the moon and stars crept across the sky with agonizing slowness. Sometimes the brilliant beacon of a satellite would drift from west to east, traveling much more swiftly than any of the stars, and in the opposite direction. It was maddening to know that up on the space stations were men and instruments that could easily locate him, if they bothered to search. But of course there was no reason why they should. At last the moon went down, and in the brief darkness before dawn, the sea once more came alight with phosphorescence. The graceful, superbly streamlined bodies all around the raft were outlined with fire. Every time one of them shot into the air, the trajectory of its leap was a glowing rainbow in the night. This time Johnny did not welcome the dawn. Now he knew how pitiful his defenses were against the tropical sun. He re-erected his little tent, crept beneath it, and tried to turn his thoughts away from drink. It was impossible. Every few minutes he found himself picturing cold milkshakes, glasses of iced fruit juice, water flowing from faucets in sparkling streams. Yet he had been adrift for not more than 30 hours. Men had survived without water for much longer than that. The only thing that kept up his spirits was the determination and energy of his escort. The school still drove on into the west, carrying the raft before it with undiminished speed. Johnny no longer puzzled himself about the mystery of the dolphin's behavior. That was a problem that would solve itself in good time, or not at all. And then, about mid-morning, he caught his first glimpse of land. For many minutes he was afraid that it was merely a cloud on the horizon. But if so, it was strange that it was the only cloud in the sky, and that it lay dead ahead. Before long he could not doubt that it was an island. Though it seemed to float clear of the water, and the heat haze made its outlines dance and shimmer against the skyline, an hour later he could see its details clearly. It was long and low, and completely covered with trees. A narrow beach of dazzling white sand surrounded it. and beyond the beach there seemed to be a very wide, shallow reef, for there was a line of white breakers at least a mile out at sea. At first Johnny could see no signs of life, but at last, with great relief, he spotted a thin stream of smoke rising from the wooded interior. Where there was smoke, there were human beings, and the water for which his whole body was now craving. He was still several miles from the island when the dolphins gave him a bad shock. They were turning aside, as if to bypass the land that was now so close. Then Johnny understood what they were doing. The reef was too great an obstacle. They were going to outflank it and approach the island from the other side. The detour took at least an hour, but Johnny's mind was at rest, now that he felt sure that he was nearing safety. As the raft and its untiring escort swung around to the western side of the island, he saw first a small group of boats at anchor, then some low white buildings, then a collection of huts with dark-skinned people moving among them. There was a fairly large community here, on this lonely speck in the Pacific. Now at last the dolphins seemed a little hesitant, and Johnny got the impression that they were reluctant to go into the shallow water. They pushed the raft slowly past the anchored boats, then backed off as if to say, "It's up to you now." Johnny felt an overwhelming impulse to say some words of thanks, but his mouth was too dry for speech. So he stepped quietly off the raft, found himself in water only waist-deep, and waded ashore. There were people running along the beach toward him, but they could wait. He turned toward the lovely, powerful creatures who had brought him on this incredible journey, and waved them a grateful farewell. Already they were turning back toward their home, in the deep water of the open sea. Then something seemed to happen to his legs, and as the sand came up to hit him, dolphins, island, and everything else vanished from his consciousness. Chapter 5. When Johnny awoke, he was lying on a low bed inside a very clean, white-walled room. A fan was spinning above his head, and light filtered in through a curtain-covered window. A cane chair, a small table, a chest of drawers, and a wash-basin completed the furniture. Even without the faint smell of disinfectant, he would have known that he was in a hospital. He sat up in bed and immediately yelped with pain. From head to foot he seemed to be on fire. When he looked down at his body, it was an angry red, and patches of skin were peeling off in large flakes. He had already received some medical attention, for the worst places had been liberally covered with white ointment. Johnny gave up the idea of moving, at least for the time being, and collapsed back into bed with another involuntary cry. At that moment the door opened, and an enormous woman came into the room. Her arms were like bolsters, and the rest of her was built on the same scale. She must have weighed at least 250 pounds, yet she was not unhealthily fat. She was simply huge.
"Well, young man," she said, "what's all the noise? I never heard such a fuss about a little sunburn."
A broad smile spread across her flat, chocolate-brown face, just in time to check Johnny's indignant answer. He managed a feeble grin in reply, and submitted while she took his pulse and temperature.
"Now," she said, as she put away the thermometer, "I'm going to send you to sleep, and when you wake up all the pain will be gone. But before I do that, you'd better give me your address so we can telephone your family."
Johnny stiffened, despite his burns. After going through all this, he was determined not to be sent home by the next boat. "I haven't any family," he said. "There's no one I want to send a message to." The nurse's eyebrows rose a fraction of an inch.
"Hmm," she said, in a skeptical tone of voice. "Well, in that case, we'll give you your nightcap right away."
"Just a minute," pleaded Johnny. "Please tell me where I am. Is this Australia?" The nurse took her time in answering as she slowly poured a colorless fluid into a measuring glass. "Yes and no," she said. "This is Australian territory, though it's 100 miles from the mainland. You're on an island in the Great Barrier Reef, and very lucky to have reached it. Here, swallow this. It doesn't taste too bad." Johnny made a face, but the nurse was speaking the truth. As the medicine went down, he asked one more question.
"What's this place called?" The huge nurse gave a chuckle that sounded like a small thunderstorm going by.
"You should know," she said.
The drug must have been very quick-acting, because Johnny barely caught her next words before he was unconscious again. We call it Dolphin Island. The next time he woke up, he felt a slight stiffness, but all the burning had gone. So had half his skin, and for the next few days he was molting like a snake. Nurse, who had informed him that her name was Tessie, and that she came from the island of Tonga, watched approvingly while he ate a hearty meal of eggs, canned meat, and tropical fruits. After that, he felt ready for anything, and was anxious to start exploring at once.
"Don't be so impatient," said Nurse Tessie. "There's plenty of time."
She was going through a bundle of clothing, hunting for shorts and shirt that would fit Johnny.
"Here, try these for size. And take this hat, too. Keep out of the sun until you've worked up a proper tan. If you don't, you'll be back here again, and that would make me very angry."
"I'll be careful," promised Johnny. He decided that it would be an extremely bad idea to make Nurse angry. She put two fingers in her mouth and blew a piercing whistle, whereupon a tiny girl appeared almost instantly.
"Here's your dolphin boy, Annie," said Nurse. "Take him to the office. Doctor's waiting."
Johnny followed the child along paths of crushed coral fragments, blindingly white in the fierce sun. They wandered between large shady trees, which looked rather like oaks, except that their leaves were several sizes too big. Johnny was a little disappointed by this. He had always believed that tropical islands were covered with palms. Presently the narrow road opened into a large clearing, and Johnny found himself looking at a group of single-storied concrete buildings linked together with covered walks. Some had large windows behind which people could be seen at work. Others had no windows at all, and looked as if they contained machines or pipes and cables let into them. Johnny followed his little guide up the steps to the main building. As he walked past the windows, he could see the people inside staring at him curiously. That was not surprising, in view of the way he had arrived here. Sometimes he wondered if that strange ride was all imagination. It seemed too fantastic to be true. And was this place really called Dolphin Island, as Nurse Tessie had said? That would be an altogether outrageous coincidence. His guide, who had apparently been too shy or too overawed to utter a word, disappeared as soon as she had led Johnny to a door marked Dr. Keith, Assistant Director. He knocked, waited until a voice said, "Come in," and pushed his way into a large air-conditioned office, refreshingly cool after the heat outside. Dr. Keith was a man in his 40s and looked like a college professor. Even though he was sitting behind his desk, Johnny could see that he was unusually tall and gangling. He was also the first white person he had seen on the island. The doctor waved Johnny to a chair, saying in a slightly nasal voice as he did so, "Sit down, Sonny." Johnny didn't like being called Sonny, nor did he like the doctor's Australian accent, which he had never before encountered at close quarters. But he said, "Thank you," very politely, sat down, and waited for the next move. It was completely unexpected.
"Perhaps you'd better begin by telling us," said Dr. Keith, "just what happened to you after the Santa Ana went down."
Johnny stared at him open-mouthed, all his plans in ruins. They had been only half-formed plans, but he had at least hoped that he could pose for a little while as a shipwrecked sailor suffering from loss of memory. But if they knew how he had traveled, they also knew where he had come from, and he would undoubtedly be sent home at once. He decided not to give up without a fight. "I've never heard of the Santa, whatever her name is," he replied innocently.
"Give us credit for a little intelligence, Sonny. When you came ashore in such a novel manner, we naturally radioed the Coast Guard to find if any ships had been lost. They told us that the crew of the hover freighter Santa Ana had put in at Brisbane, reporting that their ship had sunk about 100 miles east of us. However, they also reported that everyone had been saved, even the ship's cat."
"So that seemed to rule out the Santa Ana, until we had the bright idea that you might be a stowaway.
After that, it was just a matter of checking with the police along the Santa Ana's route. The doctor paused for a moment, picked up a briar pipe from his desk, and examined it as if he'd never seen such an object before. It was at this point that Johnny decided that Dr. Keith was just playing with him, and his initial dislike went up a few more degrees.
"You'd be surprised how many boys still run away from home," continued that annoying voice. "It took several hours to find out who you were, and I must say that when we called your Aunt Martha, she didn't sound particularly grateful. I don't really blame you for clearing out."
Perhaps Dr. Keith wasn't so bad after all. "What are you going to do with me, now I'm here?" asked Johnny. He realized, to his alarm, that there was a slight quiver in his voice, and that tears of disappointment and frustration were not far away.
"There's not much that we can do at the moment," said the doctor, raising Johnny's hopes at once. "Our boat's over at the mainland, and won't be back until tomorrow. It will be a week after that before it sails again, so you have 8 days here that you can count on."
8 days! His luck was still holding out. Many things could happen in that time, and he would make sure that they did. In the next half hour, Johnny described his ride back from the wreck while Dr. Keith made notes and asked questions. Nothing about the story seemed to surprise him, and when Johnny had finished, he pulled a sheaf of photographs out of his desk drawer. There were pictures of dolphins. Johnny had no idea that there were so many different varieties.
"Could you identify your friends?" the doctor asked.
"I'll try," said Johnny, riffling through the prints. He quickly eliminated all but 3 probables and 2 possibles. Dr. Keith looked quite satisfied with his choice of dolphins.
"Yes," he said, "it would have to be one of those."
Then he asked Johnny a very odd question.
"Did any of them speak to you?"
At first Johnny thought he was joking. Then he saw that Dr. Keith was perfectly serious. "They made all sorts of noises, squeaks and whistles and barks, but nothing that I could understand."
"Nothing like this?"
asked the doctor. He pressed a button on his desk, and from a loud speaker at the side of the office came a sound like a rusty gate creaking on its hinges. Then there was a string of noises that reminded Johnny of an old-fashioned gas engine starting up. And after that, clearly and unmistakably, "Good morning, Dr. Keith." The words were spoken more quickly than a man could utter them, but they were perfectly distinct. And even then, on that first hearing, Johnny knew that he was not listening to a mere echo or a parrot-like repetition. The animal that said, "Good morning, Dr. Keith," had known exactly what it was doing.
"You seem surprised," chuckled the doctor. "Hadn't you heard that dolphins could speak?"
Johnny shook his head.
"Well, it's been known for half a century that they have an elaborate language of their own. We've been trying to learn it, and at the same time trying to teach them basic English. We've made a good deal of progress thanks to the techniques worked out by Professor Kazan. You'll meet him when he comes back from the mainland. He's very anxious to hear your story. Meanwhile, I'd better find someone to look after you."
Dr. Keith pressed a switch, and a reply came at once from an intercom speaker.
"School here. Yes, doctor?" "Any of the older boys free at the moment?"
"You can have Mick, and welcome to him."
"Good. Send him around to the office."
Johnny sighed. Even on an island as small and remote as this, it seemed that one couldn't escape from school. Chapter 6. As a guide to the island, Mick Nauru had just one drawback. He would exaggerate. Most of his tall stories were so outrageous that there was no danger of taking them seriously. But sometimes Johnny was left in doubt. Was it really true, for instance, that Nurse Tessie, or Two-Ton Tessie, as the islanders called her, had left home because the big girls on Tonga poked fun at her for being so small? Johnny didn't think so, but Mick assured him that it was perfectly true.
"Ask her if you don't believe me," he said, his face completely solemn beneath his huge mop of black frizzy hair.
Luckily, his other information was more easily checked, and on matters that were really important, he was quite serious. As soon as Dr. Keith had handed Johnny over to him, Mick took him on a quick tour of the island and introduced him to its geography. There was quite a lot in a small area, and it was several days before Johnny knew his way around. The first thing he learned was that Dolphin Island had two populations, the scientists and technicians of the research station, and the fisher folk who operated the boats and made a living from the sea. The fishing community also provided the workers who ran the power station, water supply, and other essential services, such as the cookhouse, laundry, and the tiny farm of 10 pampered cows.
"We brought in the cows," explained Mick, "after the professor tried to process dolphin milk. That's the only time we've ever had a mutiny on the island."
"How long have you been here?" asked Johnny. "Were you born here?"
"Oh, no, my people come from Darnley Island, up in the Torres Strait. They moved here 5 years ago when I was 12. The pay was good, and it sounded interesting."
"And is it interesting?"
"You bet. I wouldn't go back to Darnley or the mainland either."
"Wait until you see the reef and you'll understand why." They had left the cleared paths and were taking a short cut through the small forest which covered most of the island. Though the trees were closely packed, it was not hard to push a way through them, for there were none of the thorns and creepers that Johnny had expected in a tropical forest. The plant life of the island was wild but well behaved. Some of the trees appeared to have small piles of sticks propped around their bases, and it was some time before Johnny realized that the props were actually part of the trees. It seemed that they did not trust the soft soil in which they were growing, and had sent out extra roots above ground as buttresses.
"They're pandanus," explained Mick. "Some people call them breadfruit trees because you can make a kind of bread from them. I ate some once. It tasted horrible. Look out!"
He was too late. Johnny's right leg had sunk into the ground up to his knee, and as he floundered to extricate himself, the left leg plunged even deeper.
"Sorry," said Mick, who didn't look at all sorry. "I should have warned you. There's a mutton bird colony here. They make their nests in the ground like rabbits, and in some places you can't walk a foot without falling into them."
"Thank you for telling me," said Johnny sarcastically, as he clambered out and dusted himself off. There were a great many things to learn, it seemed, on Dolphin Island. He came to grief several times in the burrows of the mutton birds, or wedge-tailed shearwaters, to give them their proper name, before they emerged from the trees and walked down onto the beach on the eastern side of the island, facing the great emptiness of the open Pacific. It was hard to believe that he had come from far beyond that distant horizon, brought here by a miracle he still did not understand. There was no sign of human life. They might have been the only inhabitants. This coast was exposed to the seasonal gales, so all the buildings and dock installations were on the opposite side of the island. A huge tree trunk, cast up on the sand and bleached white by months and years of sun, was a silent monument to some past hurricane. There were even great boulders of dead coral, weighing many tons, which could only have been hurled up onto the beach by wave action, and yet it all looked so peaceful now. The boys started to walk along the sand dunes between the edge of the forest and the coral-covered beach. Mick was searching, and presently he found what he was looking for. Something large had crawled up out of the sea, leaving what looked like tank tracks in the sand. At the end of the tracks, high above the water level, there was an area of flattened sand in which Mick commenced to dig with his hands. Johnny helped him, and about a foot down they came across dozens of eggs the size and shape of table tennis balls. They were not hard-shelled, however, but leathery and flexible. Mick took off his shirt, made a bag out of it, and packed in all the eggs he could.
"Do you know what they are?"
he asked. "Yes," said Johnny promptly to Mick's obvious disappointment. "Turtle eggs. I saw a movie on television once, showing how the baby turtles hatch and then dig themselves out of the sand. What are you going to do with these?"
"Eat them, of course. They're fine, fried with rice."
"Ugh," said Johnny. "You won't catch me trying it."
"You won't know," answered Mick. "We've got a very clever cook."
They followed the curve of the beach around the north of the island, then the west, before coming back to the settlement. Just before they reached it, they encountered a large pool or tank, connected to the sea by a canal. As the tide was now out, the canal was closed by a locked gate, which trapped water in the pool until the sea returned. "There you are," said Mick. "That's what the island is all about." Swimming slowly around in the pool, just as he had seen them out in the Pacific, were two dolphins. Johnny wished he could have examined them more closely, but a wire mesh fence made it impossible to get near the pool. On the fence, in large red letters, was a message which read, "Quiet, please. Hydrophones in action." They tiptoed dutifully past, then Mick explained, "The prof doesn't like anyone talking near the dolphins. Says it's liable to confuse them. One night some crazy fisherman got drunk and came and shouted a lot of bad language at them. There was an awful row. He was chucked out on the next boat."
"What sort of man is the prof?" asked Johnny.
"Oh, he's fine, except on Sunday afternoons."
"What happens then?"
"Every Sunday morning his old lady calls and tries to talk him into coming home. He won't go. Says he hates Moscow. It's too hot in the summer and too cold in the winter. So they have terrific fights, but every few months they compromise and meet at somewhere like Yalta." Johnny thought this over. He was anxious to learn all that he could about Professor Kazan, in the hope of improving his chances of staying on the island. Mick's description sounded a little alarming. Still, as Sunday had just passed, the professor should be in a good temper for several days.
"Can he really talk dolphin language?" asked Johnny.
"I didn't think anyone could imitate those weird noises." "He can't speak more than a few words, but he can translate tape recordings with the help of computers, and then he can make new tapes and talk back to them. It's a complicated business, but it works."
Johnny was impressed, and his curiosity was aroused. He had always liked to know how things worked, and he couldn't imagine how one would even begin to learn dolphin language.
"Well," said Mick, when he put the question to him, "have you ever stopped to think how you learned to speak?"
"By listening to my mother, I suppose," Johnny answered a little sadly. He could just remember her.
"Of course. So what the prof did was to take a mother dolphin with a new baby and put them into a pool by themselves. Then he listened to the conversation as the baby grew up. That way he learned dolphin, just as the baby did."
"It sounds almost too easy," said Johnny.
"Oh, it took years, and he's still learning. But now he has a vocabulary of thousands of words, and he's even started to write dolphin history."
"History?"
"Well, you can call it that. Because they don't have books, they've developed wonderful memories. They can tell us about things that happened in the sea ages ago. At least that's what the prof says. And it makes sense. Before men invented writing, they had to carry everything in their own heads. The dolphins have done the same."
Johnny pondered these surprising facts until they had reached the administrative block and completed the circuit of the island. At the sight of all these buildings housing so many busy workers and complicated machines, he was struck by a more down-to-earth thought. "Who pays for all this?" he asked. "It must cost a fortune to run."
"Not much, compared to the money that goes into space," Mick answered. "The prof started 15 years ago with about 6 helpers. When he began getting results, the big science foundations gave him all the support he needed. So now we have to tidy the place up every 6 months for a lot of fossils who call themselves an inspection committee. I've heard the prof say it was much more fun in the old days."
That might be true, thought Johnny. But it looked as if it was still a lot of fun now, and he intended to share it.
Chapter 7. The hydrofoil launch Flying Fish came scudding out of the west at 50 knots, making the crossing from the Australian mainland in 2 hours. When she was near the Dolphin Island Reef, she retracted her huge water skis, settled down like a conventional boat, and finished her journey at a sedate 10 knots. Johnny knew that she was in sight when the whole population of the island started to migrate down to the jetty. He followed out of curiosity, and stood watching on the beach as the white-painted launch came cautiously down the channel blasted through the coral. Professor Kazan, wearing a spotlessly white tropical suit and a white-brimmed hat, was the first ashore. He was warmly greeted by a reception committee in which technicians, fishermen,
Clerical staff and children were all mixed up together. The island community was extremely democratic. Everyone regarded himself as the equal of everyone else. But Professor Kazan, as Johnny soon discovered, was in a class of his own, and the islanders treated him with a curious mixture of respect, affection, and pride. Johnny also discovered that if you came down to the beach to watch the flying fish arrive, you were expected to help unload her. For the next hour, he assisted an impressive flow of parcels and packing cases on its way from boat to stores. The job had just been finished, and he was having a welcome cool drink, when the public address system asked him if he would kindly report to Tech Block as soon as possible. When he arrived, he was shown into a large room full of electronic equipment. Professor Kazan and Dr. Keith were sitting at an elaborate control desk and took no notice of him at all. Johnny didn't mind. He was too fascinated at what was going on. A strange series of sounds repeated over and over again was coming from a loudspeaker. It was like the dolphin noises that Johnny had already heard, but there was a subtle difference. After about a dozen repeats, he realized what this was. The sounds had been slowed down considerably to allow sluggish human ears to appreciate their fine details. But this was not all. Each time the string of dolphin noises came from the speaker, it also appeared as a pattern of light and shade on a large television screen. The pattern of bright lines and dark bands looked like a kind of map, and though it meant nothing to Johnny's untrained eye, it obviously conveyed a good deal to the scientists. They watched it intently every time it flashed on the screen, and occasionally they adjusted controls that brightened some areas and darkened others. Suddenly, the professor noticed Johnny, turned off the sound, and swiveled around in his seat. However, he did not switch off the picture, which continued flashing silently and steadily with such hypnotic rhythm that Johnny's eyes kept coming back to it. All the same, he made the most of this first opportunity of studying Professor Kazan. The scientist was a plump, gray-haired man in his late 50s. He had a kindly but rather distant expression, as if he wanted to be friends with everyone, yet preferred to be left with his own thoughts. As Johnny was to discover, he could be excellent company when he relaxed, but at other times he would seem to be somewhere else altogether, even when he was talking to you. It was not that he bore much resemblance to the absent-minded professor of the popular imagination. No one could be less absent-minded than Professor Kazan when it came to dealing with practical matters. He seemed to be able to operate on two levels at once. Part of his mind would be coping with the affairs of everyday life, and another part would be wrestling with some profound scientific problem. No wonder, therefore, that he often appeared to be listening to some inner voice that no one else could hear.
"Sit down, Johnny," he began. "Dr. Keith radioed about you while I was over on the mainland. I suppose you realize just how lucky you've been."
"Yes, sir," answered Johnny with considerable feeling.
"We've known for centuries that dolphins sometimes help humans to shore. In fact, such legends go back for over 2,000 years, though no one took them very seriously until our time. But you weren't merely pushed to land. You were carried 100 miles. On top of that, you were brought directly to us. But why? This is what we'd very much like to know. I don't suppose you have any ideas."
Johnny was flattered by the question, but could do little to answer it. "Well," he said slowly, "they must have known that you were working with dolphins, though I can't imagine how they found out."
"That's easy to answer," Dr. Keith interjected. "The dolphins we've released must have told them. Remember, Johnny recognized 5 of them from photographs I showed him when he first arrived."
Professor Kazan nodded.
"Yes, and that gives us some valuable information. It means that the coastal species we work with and their deep-sea cousins speak the same language. We didn't know that before."
"But we're still in the dark about their motives," said Dr. Keith. "If wild dolphins that have never had any direct contact with men go to all this trouble, it suggests that they want something from us, and want it badly. Perhaps rescuing Johnny meant something like, 'We've helped you, now help us.'"
"It's a plausible theory," agreed Professor Kazan. "But we won't find the answer by talking.
there's only one way to discover what Johnny's friends were driving at, and that's to ask them.
If we can find them.
Well, if they really want something, they won't be too far away. We may be able to contact them without leaving this room.
The professor threw a switch, and once more the air was full of sound. But this time Johnny soon realized he was not listening to the voice of a single dolphin, but to all the voices of the sea. It was an incredibly complex mixture of hissings and cracklings and rumblings. Mingled with these, there were chirps that might have been made by birds, faint and distant moans and the murmur of a million waves. They listened for several minutes to this fascinating medley of noises. Then the professor turned another switch on the huge machine.
That was Hydrophone West, he explained to Johnny. Now we'll try Hydro East. It's in deeper water, right off the edge of the reef.
The sound picture changed. The noise of the waves was fainter, but the moanings and creakings from the unknown creatures of the sea were much louder. Once more the professor listened for several minutes, then he switched to north and finally to south.
Run the tapes through the analyzer, will you? He asked Dr. Keith. But I'd be willing to bet, even now, that there's no large school of dolphins within 20 miles.
In that case, bang goes my theory.
Not necessarily. 20 miles is nothing to dolphins. And they're hunters, remember. So they can't stay in one place. They have to follow their food wherever it goes. The school that rescued Johnny would soon vacuum clean all the fish off our reef.
The professor rose to his feet, then continued. I'll leave you to run the analysis. It's time I went down to the pool. Come along, Johnny. I want you to meet some of my best friends. As they walked toward the beach, the professor seemed to fall into a reverie. Then he startled Johnny by suddenly and skillfully producing a string of rapidly modulated whistles. He laughed at Johnny's surprised expression.
No human being will ever speak fluent dolphin, he said. But I can make a fair attempt at a dozen of the commoner phrases. I have to keep working at them, though, and I'm afraid my accent's pretty terrible. Only dolphins that know me well can understand what I'm trying to say. And sometimes I think they're just being polite.
The professor unlocked the gate to the pool, and then carefully locked it behind him.
Everyone wants to play with Susie and Sputnik, but I can't allow it, he explained. At least, not while I'm trying to teach them English.
Susie was a sleek, excited matron of some 300 pounds, who reared herself half out of the water as they approached. Sputnik, her 9-month-old son, was more reserved, or perhaps more shy. He kept his mother between himself and the visitors.
Hello, Susie, said the professor, speaking with exaggerated clarity. Hello, Sputnik.
Then he pursed his lips and let fly with that complicated whistle. Something went wrong halfway through, and he swore softly under his breath before going back to start afresh. Susie thought this was very funny. She gave several yelps of dolphin laughter, then squirted a jet of water at her visitors, though she was polite enough to miss them. Then she swam up to the professor, who reached into his pocket and produced a plastic bag full of titbits. He held one piece high in the air, whereupon Susie backed away a few yards, came shooting out of the water like a rocket, took the food neatly from the professor's fingers, and dived back into the pool with scarcely a splash. Then she emerged again and said distinctly,
"Thank you, Professor."
She was obviously waiting for more, but Professor Kazan shook his head.
"No, Susie," he said, patting her on the back. "No more. Food time soon."
She gave a snort that seemed to express disgust, then went racing around the pool like a motorboat, clearly showing off.
As Sputnik followed her, the professor said to Johnny, "See if you can feed him. I'm afraid he doesn't trust me."
Johnny took the tidbit, which smelled to high heaven of fish, oil, and chemicals. It was, he found later, the dolphin equivalent of tobacco or candy. The professor had concocted it only after years of research. The animals loved the stuff so much that they would do almost anything to earn some. Johnny knelt at the edge of the pool and waved the bait.
"Sputnik!" he called. "Here, Sputnik!"
The little dolphin reared out of the water and regarded him doubtfully. It looked at its mother, it looked at Professor Kazan, and then again at Johnny. Though it appeared tempted, it would not approach him. Instead, it gave a snort and promptly submerged, after which it started tearing around in the depths of the pool. It did not seem to be going anywhere in particular. Like some human beings who cannot make up their minds, it was simply galloping off in all directions. "I think it's afraid of the professor," Johnny decided. He walked along the edge of the pool until he had put 50 feet between himself and the scientist, then called to Sputnik again. His theory worked. The dolphin surveyed the new situation, approved of it, and swam slowly toward Johnny. It still looked a little suspicious as it raised its snout and opened its mouth, displaying an alarming number of small but needle-sharp teeth. Johnny felt distinctly relieved when it took the reward without nipping his fingers. After all, Sputnik was a carnivore, and Johnny would not care to feed a half-grown lion cub with his bare hands. The young dolphin hovered at the edge of the pool, obviously waiting for more. "No, Sputnik," said Johnny, remembering the professor's words to Susie. "No, Sputnik. Food time soon." The dolphin remained only inches away, so Johnny reached out to stroke it. Though it shied a little, it did not withdraw, but permitted him to run his hand along its back. He was surprised to find that the animal's skin was soft and flexible, like rubber. Nothing could have been more unlike the scaly body of a fish, and no one who stroked a dolphin could ever again forget that it was a warm-blooded mammal. Johnny would have liked to remain playing with Sputnik, but the professor was signaling to him. As they walked away from the pool, the scientist remarked jokingly, "My feelings are quite hurt. I've never been able to get near Sputnik, and you did it the first time. You seem to have a way with dolphins. Have you ever kept any pets before?"
"No, sir," said Johnny, "except pollywogs, and that was a long time ago."
"Well," the professor chuckled, "I don't think we can count them." They had walked on for a few more yards when Professor Kazan started speaking in a completely different tone of voice, addressing Johnny very seriously as an equal, not as a boy 40 years younger.
"I'm a scientist," he said, "but I'm also a superstitious Russian peasant. Though logic tells me it's nonsense, I'm beginning to think that fate sent you here. First, there was the way you arrived, like something out of a Greek myth. And now Sputnik feeds out of your hands. Pure coincidence, of course, but a sensible man makes coincidences work for him."
"What on earth is he driving at?" wondered Johnny. But the professor said no more until they were about to re-enter the tech block. Then he suddenly remarked with a slight chuckle, "I understand you're in no great hurry to get home." Johnny's heart skipped a beat.
"That's right, sir," he said eagerly. "I want to stay here as long as I can. I'd like to learn more about your dolphins."
"Not mine," corrected the professor firmly. "Every dolphin is a person in his own right, an individual with more freedom than we can ever know on land. They don't belong to anyone, and I hope they never will. I want to help them, not only for science, but because it's a privilege to do so.
Never think of them as animals. In their language, they call themselves the people of the sea, and that's the best name for them."
It was the first time that Johnny had seen the professor so animated, but he could understand his feelings, for he owed his life to the people of the sea, and it was a debt he hoped he could repay. Chapter 8. Around Dolphin Island lay a magic kingdom, the reef. In a lifetime, one could not exhaust its marvels. Johnny had never dreamed that such places existed, crammed with weird and beautiful creatures in such multitudes that the fields and forests of the land seemed dead by comparison. At high tide, the reef was completely covered by the sea, and only the narrow belt of white sand surrounding the island was left exposed. But a few hours later, the transformation was incredible. Though the range between high and low tide was only 3 feet, the reef was so flat that the water withdrew for miles. Indeed, in some directions the tide retreated so far that the sea disappeared from sight, and the coral plateau was uncovered all the way to the horizon. This was the time to explore the reef. All the equipment needed was a stout pair of shoes, a broad-rimmed hat to give protection from the sun, and a face mask. The shoes were far and away the most important item, for
for the sharp, brittle coral could inflict scars that easily became infected, and then took weeks to heal. The first time that Johnny went out onto the reef, Mick was his guide, because he had no idea what to expect. Everything was very strange and a little frightening. He did well to be cautious until he knew his way around. There were things on the reef, small, innocent-looking things that could easily kill him if he was careless. The two boys walked straight out from the beach on the western side of the island, where the exposed reef was only a half a mile wide. At first, they crossed an uninteresting no-man's land of dead, broken coral, shattered fragments cast up by the storms of centuries. The whole island was built of such fragments, which the ages had covered with a thin layer of earth, then with grass and weeds, and at last with trees. They were soon beyond the zone of dead coral, and it seemed to Johnny that he was moving through a garden of strange, petrified plants. There were delicate twigs and branches of colored stone and more massive shapes like giant mushrooms or fungi, so solid that it was safe to walk on them. Yet, despite their appearance, these were not plants, but the creations of animal life. When Johnny bent down to examine them, he could see that their surfaces were pierced by thousands of tiny holes. Each was the cell of a single coral polyp, a little creature like a small sea anemone, and each cell had been built of lime secreted by the animal during its lifetime. When it died, the empty cell would remain, and the next generation would build upon it. And so the reef would grow, year by year, century by century. Everything that Johnny saw, the miles upon miles of flat tableland glistening beneath the sun, was the work of creatures smaller than his fingernail. And this was only one patch of coral in the whole immensity of the Great Barrier Reef, which stretched for more than 1,000 miles along the Australian coast. Now Johnny understood a remark that he had heard Professor Kazan make, that the reef was the mightiest single work of living creatures on the face of the earth. It did not take Johnny long to discover that he was walking on other creatures besides corals. Suddenly, without the slightest warning, a jet of water shot into the air only a few feet in front of him.
"Whatever did that?" he gasped.
Mick laughed at his amazement.
"Clam," he answered briefly. "He'd heard you coming."
Johnny caught the next one in time to watch it in action. The clam was about a foot across, embedded vertically in the coral, so that only its open lips were showing. The body of the creature, partly out of its shell, looked like a beautifully colored piece of velvet, dyed the richest of emeralds and blues. When Mick stamped on the rock beside it, the clam instantly snapped shut in alarm, and the water it shot upward just missed Johnny's face.
"This is only a little feller," said Mick contemptuously.
"You have to go deep to find the big ones. They grow up to 4 or 5 feet across. My grandfather says that when he was working on a pearling lugger out of Cooktown, he met a clam 12 feet across. But he's famous for his tall stories, so I don't believe it." Johnny didn't believe in the 5-foot clams either. But as he found later, this time Mick was speaking the exact truth. It wasn't safe to dismiss any story about the reef and its creatures as pure imagination. They had walked another 100 yards, accompanied by occasional squirts from annoyed clams, when they came to a small rock pool. Because there was no wind to ruffle the surface, Johnny could see the fish darting through the depths as clearly as if they had been suspended in air. They were all the colors of the rainbow, patterned in stripes and circles and spots, as if some mad painter had run amuck with his palette. Not even the most garish butterflies were more colorful and striking than the fish flitting in and out of the corals. And the pool held many other inhabitants. When Mick pointed them out to him, Johnny saw 2 long feelers protruding from the entrance of a little cave. They were waving anxiously to and fro, as if making a survey of the outside world.
"Painted crayfish," said Mick. "Maybe we'll catch him on the way back. They're very good eating, barbecued with lots of butter."
In the next 5 minutes he had shown Johnny a score of different creatures. There were several kinds of beautifully patterned shells, 5-armed starfish crawling slowly along the bottom in search of prey, hermit crabs hiding in the shells that they had made their homes, and a thing like a giant slug, which squirted out a cloud of purple ink when Mick prodded it. There was also an octopus, the first that Johnny had ever seen. It was a baby a few inches across, and it was lurking shyly in the shadows, where only an expert like Mick could have spotted it. When he scared it out into the open, it slithered over the corals with a graceful, flowing motion, changing its color from dull gray to a delicate pink as it did so. Much to his surprise, Johnny decided that it was quite a pretty little creature, though he expected that he would change his views if he met a really large specimen. He could have spent all day exploring this one small pool, but Mick was in a hurry to move along. So they continued their trek toward the distant line of the sea, zigzagging to avoid areas of coral too fragile to bear their weight. Once, Mick stopped to collect a spotted shell the size and shape of a fir cone. "Look at this," he said, holding it up to Johnny. A black pointed hook, like a tiny sickle, was vainly stabbing at him from one end of the shell. "Poisonous," said Mick. "If that gets you, you'll be very sick. You could even die." He put the shell back on the rocks while Johnny looked at it thoughtfully. Such a beautiful, innocent-looking object. Yet it contained death. He did not forget that lesson in a hurry. But he also learned that the reef was perfectly safe to explore if you followed two common-sense rules. The first was to watch where you were stepping. The second was never to touch anything unless you knew that it was harmless. At last they reached the edge of the reef and stood looking down into the gently heaving sea. The tide was still going out and water was pouring off the exposed coral down hundreds of little valleys it had carved in the living rock. There were large, deep pools here, open to the sea, and in them swam fish much bigger than any Johnny had seen before. "Come along," said Mick, adjusting his face mask. With scarcely a ripple, he slipped into the nearest pool, not even looking back to see if Johnny was following him. Johnny hesitated for a moment, decided that he did not want to appear a coward, and lowered himself gingerly over the brittle coral. As soon as the water rose above his face mask, he forgot all his fears. The submarine world into which he had looked from above was even more beautiful, now that he was actually floating face down on the surface. He seemed like a fish himself, swimming in a giant aquarium, and able to see everything with crystal clarity through the window of his mask. Very slowly he followed Mick along the winding walls, between coral cliffs that grew farther and farther apart as they approached the sea. At first the water was only 2 or 3 feet deep, then, quite abruptly, the bottom fell away almost vertically, and before Johnny realized what had happened, he was in water 20 feet deep. He had swum off the great plateau of the reef and was heading for the open sea. For a moment he was really frightened. He stopped swimming and marked time in the water, looking back over his shoulder to check that safety was only a few yards behind him. Then he looked ahead once more, ahead and downward. It was impossible to guess how far he could see into the depths, 100 feet at least. He was looking down a long, steep slope that led into a realm completely different from the brightly lit, colorful pools which he had just left. From a world sparkling with sunlight, he was staring into a blue, mysterious gloom. And far down in that gloom, huge shapes were moving back and forth in a stately dance.
"What are they?"
he whispered to his companion.
"Groupers," said Mick.
"Watch." Then, to Johnny's alarm, he slipped beneath the surface and arrowed down into the depths as swiftly and gracefully as any fish. End of Side 1. To continue, turn the cassette over.